I've got to take medicine at this point.
This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is July 12th in the year 2001, and I'm with Wally Welker at his apartment at 1802 Fordham, and we're going to continue the discussion. Well, actually, this is our third session. The last session was about a week or two ago. Today, Wally, last time we talked about the department itself. We brought you to Yerkes, to the lab down in Florida, and we got you kind of transferred over to Madison, and then we went back last week and we talked about Clinton Woolsey and all the very distinguished people and your neuro lunches or neuro dinners or what did you call them?
Neuro feasts,
that's it. And today we're going, and your colleagues like Hind and Benjamin and people like that. Today we're going to talk about you in the department. Now, you came in on September 1st, 1954. That's when you began at UW.
Right.
What research interests did you bring with you when you arrived in Madison?
Well, I've always had a very simplistic approach to deal with my own strong curiosity. And the curiosity, by its nature, is exploratory. And playfulness and curiosity are sort of a kind. And early playfulness in children is a way of exploring your own body and the visual and tactile things. And so that exploration and play are very closely allied in their inception. And they may become separated in our minds, at least, later, because you're curious about something, but it's not exactly playful. But many people who are very curious also stay very playful in their minds. For some reason, I acknowledge the fact that everything that people do or see or feel or hear or smell, or taste, and the emotions, I have our experiences. Thinking is a kind of experience. And these are all, they issue from brain operations. And that became very clear to me very early, that the brain was responsible for all the phenomena that you've experience in your life, or you see in other people, or you see in animals. And there was a commonality in expression of brain power in all mammals, in all vertebrates, really. So it's a simple idea, and it's the idea of looking at the brain to see what is common among vertebrates, among mammals, was a powerful drive. That was sort of a general approach that I came to study neuroscience with that viewpoint. And for me, it was never, there was never a question about what had to be done. I had to learn more and more about how the brain was constructed, how it was wired, how neural impulses were shuttle around, and how all these expressions of the brain from where did they come in the brain and what prompted them to sequence themselves so that one thing leads to the next. And so when you're walking, there's a very sophisticated integration of movement of all your limbs, your body parts, and the joints, and feedback from the senses that guides an individual in an orderly way, so it looks like it's a natural thing. This is the way things work. If we were thinking about machines, you would have to examine each facet of the machine to know what it did and make sure. Build into it what do you want it to do next. Artificial intelligence is trying to do that with trying to mimic the operations of the brain. But, so I was convinced that the answers to why all these things occurred and how they occurred, and the sequencing and timing, and the integration of the different things that were done by a person or an animal, were handled somehow by this elaborate machinery. And I wanted to know how the machinery was constructed and how it worked. So that's been my overriding motivation throughout my career.
Now, you mentioned a couple of interviews ago that you had written a letter to Woolsey about why you wanted to come and study at UW, and that you met with him when you came. You came for an interview. Did you express what you were talking about right here? Was it as clear to you at that point?
Yeah, it was clear, and I wrote my letter a request for coming. Would he accept me as a as a trainee? I wrote a letter in handwritten that I later saw it, and it was so.
Yeah, you mentioned that it was kind of simplistic. So.
Yeah, it was like a farm boy, country hick, trying to express something to a scholar. But he saw through that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What did he see when he read that?
He saw the motivation, and he knew his own life history. It probably was very similar. His curiosity about the nervous system was strong and long-lasting and kept digging deeper and deeper. And so he accepted me, and I think I was on the same wavelength with him. And
did you sense that early on, that you were on the same wavelength, that you could communicate?
Yeah, it was very reverent of him and respectful. He was like a god in a sense, but yet I knew that I was part of his team.
Now, I think you mentioned last time, or two times ago, maybe we talked off mic. Sometimes we talk off mic and on mic, and it gets a little confused. But I think you said that Woolsey really determined, would assign you research initially.
Yeah.
Now, how did he take your interests and, or what he saw as your interests into mind when he pushed you out? And what?
Well, I think he must have. We never talked about it, but I think my interests were so broad. Mm-hmm. Interested in behavior, interested in animals and general and the details of how the brain works and all aspects of how the brain works. And I think that must have been his background motivation. And so he probably pushed me in this or that direction based on where I was at that moment. Mm-hmm. And he encouraged me to take animals, experiment with them. He showed me how to open them up, expose the brains, encourage the use of the libraries and the literature, and attending conferences where other like-minded people would discuss the issues and brain function.
So he was your mentor when you were there.
Yeah,
he did it personally. He didn't do it through a...
Yeah, no, he was my mentor. I worked with him directly in the early experiments, and he would, with all of us trainees, we were apprentices, and we would do what he did and mimic his style and do it correctly the way he wanted. His standards are so high that it was a great model. So it was the best learning environment it could ever be. You were set high standards, and you were encouraged and urged to achieve them.
Now, you said that that he was good at perceiving where you needed to go, and was he generally that way with his students? Was he perceptive and determining where they were?
Yeah, I think in the people who came to him probably felt that he was too pushy, and they may have had their own special interests, but he would want them to work on projects that he thought they would benefit from. And he wanted to see exactly what you did and to show you how to do it. And those were invaluable. I just was a very obedient apprentice. I did did exactly what he said.
So he worked with surgery? You were in with surgery with him? And
sterile surgery.
I can't remember. You had not had much experience in surgery?
No, he had been trained in...
No, you. I'm talking about you.
I had no experience.
So this was your first...
I'd watched animals being slaughtered or helped in dissection of pigs, or cattle that you're going to sell the meat and use the parts of. So I'd seen the insides of creatures. And some of them are quite hard, brutal. Mm-hmm. I think the slaughter of a pig is rather grotesque. In those days, mm-hmm. the way farmers would do it, I remember they would neuter a pig, for example, so it would grow larger and not get all sexually active. And so you did this with a knife. The assistant who worked with him, with my dad, would spit tobacco juice into the wound as a disinfectant.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was no sewing up or anything of that sort. It was very grotesque. I watched all that, so I'd seen a lot of direct interventions in surgical things that were very crude. But Woolsey had a very strict medical style, and he did it as you would train a doctor today, a surgeon today.
So did he just shift some of the responsibility to you?
He'd say, well, try working on the rat. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of rats available. It was a small brain that required fairly delicate maneuvers to get at it. He encouraged bloodless surgery and very careful, precise use of instruments and microscope assistance so you could see better detail of what you were doing. And you just practiced. And you learn why the animal dying or not dying or surviving, and so you gradually became better at it just because by direct experience. That's the way the training went. let me get my fluids from my throat.
Early on, what were some of the assignments that some of your early research conducted under Woolsey? What were you doing?
Well, we'd work with him in recording from the surface, evoked potentials from the surface of the brain of a rat. He started us with rats because that's what he's going to turn us loose on for practice, for developing our skills. So he'd demonstrate it, and then we would try to mimic it. He'd say, okay, take this rat, here's how you anesthetize it, and keep it alive, and intubate it so you have respiratory patency, and you just start in. Set up your electrical, your stereotaxic machinery to allow the advanced electrode to the surface of the cortex of the brain, and allowed you to precisely locate in three dimensions where the electrode tip was placed. You had to have made the electrode, insulated it to its tip, thin tungsten wire, or stainless steel in the beginning. And so you learn a lot of technical, mechanical things that you had to do yourself. If you needed to construct a device that would hold the animal more comfortably or appropriately, you had to make it. We had a woodworking shop. Mm-hmm. And I had already had experience like that in the farm, so I, mm-hmm. with mechanical and woodworking things, we had a shop in our basement. So I became very self-sufficient in the conduct of my experimental operations. I became very good and pleased at being able to do a clean, bloodless brain exposure that animal didn't lose blood and you kept it alive, and you got it to the stage where you could lower the electrode and then turn on all your electronic equipment and adjust the amplifiers and all that, so that you'd have an oscilloscope screen, and you tap the finger of a rat, say, and then explore around the electrode to find where the evoked potential came from. And that would tell you where the tactile area of the brain was, of the cortex. And so that was his general strategy. It was a mapping strategy. Since very little was known about where these different functional areas were, auditory, visual, tactile, or...
Again, rather exciting. You were doing pioneering research. Molesey had been working on mapping for quite a while. That was sort of his life's work, wasn't it?
Yeah, he'd got it started, and he developed strategies and ways of showing, representing the data. So you'd have you'd have an array of electrode points on the brain, maybe 100 of them, spaced a millimeter apart or whatever, and at each of the points you'd have received, you'd found that one finger went to this part and another finger went there, and the elbow went here and side of the neck here and the face or the head or the lips or the eyes, around the eyes, tactile input around the eyes would go to this. And if you plot these out, you had a piece of a puzzle. You had puzzle pieces, each with a little picture of the animal on it, which you'd done, you'd created these little figurines of the animal's body, which you'd obtained by photographing the body from a different angle, making drawings of the outlines of the hand inside and out, and head from underneath and laterally and front, so that you could, when you did your experiment, you could draw where the source of the input was to the part of your place you were recording from. And that, so that's a electrophysiological mapping. That's what the technique was. Woolsey pioneered it. Other people had used it for different purposes, but he was the one who found a way to represent the data in pictorial form so that you could publish it and people could get a visual clarity of how the body surface was projecting its impulses to the brain surface.
So this is what you, these are the types of things. I forgot to mention, you were here on a postdoc initially, right?
Yeah, right.
So you were here as, you weren't here as a faculty member, you were here as a postdoc. And how long was that for?
Well, it was 2 years, and then we got an extension for another year. Then Woolsey, from his grants, ability to obtain grants for training people, was able to fund you to continue.
And were these NIH grants?
They're NIH grants. NIH just got going at that point.
So you came at a very fortunate moment. He was just really in, like he was training you personally. You weren't assigned to a research group as later on.
Right.
He was the research group, and you were the members, and he was the head of that research group.
And the things you had to explore were unknown. So you were going into new territory. And there was the excitement of that, of course.
Yes.
And learning new things.
When you started doing these mapping things, you started getting good at it, were you surprised at what you were learning about the human brain, or about the brains of the...
I was amazed that there was order, and there was pattern to the way things were connected, how the peripheral sensory surfaces were got up to the cerebral cortex. Of course, they'd gone, those impulses that start in the arm or hand, go up through the spinal cord or the medulla, up to the medulla. They make transfers to groups of cells there to another group of cells. And they, so there's transformations made of the information coming in at each of several stages before it was sent up to the cerebral cortex. And so you knew that there was, the things that came up in the cerebral cortex came from the thalamus, and that you had some other your later work with in-depth recording was to find what groups of cells in the thalamus were tactile, which ones are auditory. And we gradually acquired this knowledge in the field, and people were taking this up broader scale all across the country.
I think we talked about that a little bit. So there was a real high level of interest nationally and later internationally in the kinds of experiments that that you were doing and certainly that Woolsey was doing.
And people were sent, students came here to study with Woolsey because he's the only one that had advanced techniques to the point where you could get these reproducible and pictorially descriptive ways of describing connections, active connections from sensory surfaces. And you also did to study the motor systems because sensation is integrated with motion, activities of the body. Animal runs across the floor. It's using the feedback from this, touching the surfaces and movements of the joints and so forth to tell the brain what it is it should do in making the next step. And so you knew that these kinds of events were taking place, and they were taking place at specific places in the nervous system. Mm-hmm. That became the premise, the assumption, and it has turned out to be true. Mm. Circuits are very specific, and they're located in very definite locations of the brain. There are multiple areas for each of the functions that the brain performs in sensation and in action. And so the goal was to find where these places were and what how they were organized spatially so that, so in the motor system, for example, that movements of the thumb could be activated from one part of the cortex and finger from another part, and you'd map that out just by electrically stimulating the surface.
Wow. Now, when you were here as a postdoc, Bob Benjamin was here, mm-hmm. and Joe Hind was here as well. Did you guys essentially function as a research group with Woolsey?
Yeah. Joe Hind took care of the electrophysical equipment. And he made sure the equipment worked for recording or stimulating, and he solved all those problems. And so he was a valuable part of the team as an electrical engineer.
Now, when you became, how, at what point did you become faculty members? Did you go from postdoc to faculty?
We went from postdoc to instructor, which was a title, but we really didn't instruct. We weren't part of teaching.
Right, you were not teaching.
Or a research associate, or whatever terms that were used in those days. Those are the titles we were given. That's why we were listed in the phone book. Mm-hmm. And the projects we undertook were sort of just next phase explorations. One led to the next, and whatever you found at one set of experiments told you that you had to not now look at the next level. And in the brain, when you found the cerebral cortex is right there, it's easy to get to, and it's, you can open it up and record from it or stimulate it. But then you back down the system to through the different cell groups into the to the sense organs or to the muscles. And so you ended up tracing the circuitry backwards from cerebral cortex down to the thalamus, to the midbrain, to the medulla, to the spinal cord, and out to the nerves. They were coming in with information or going out with activity information. So the experimental strategies were fairly clear. You had to do these things this way, and it didn't make any difference, really, what you took up next, because almost everything was unknown.
Did you begin, as you grew more familiar with your situation and that Woolsey got to know you better, did you have more latitude in determining what the next direction was rather than local?
Had a lot of that latitude. Yeah.
But you would talk it over with Wolsey?
Yes.
And then he would, if he had problem questions, he'd ask you? And
we'd meet every week to report our results, and he would have consultations with us or come in and watch us doing what we were doing, often without any comment. And he approved, or he made suggestions here or there. But essentially, you were self-motivated, and once he realized that you were on track as to how to do experiments and explore the problems that had to be explored, he let you go.
Talk about the evolution of your research.
Well, my early research in college and at Yerkes and at the primate lab here was looking at behavior. And I looked at behavior everywhere. We'd go to watch a ballet at the Union Theater or a dance group and look at the motions and postures that were taken and, you know, the great control required to do this and that. And I was always thinking, how is the brain doing this? I looked at behavior in people and animals always from the viewpoint of what part of the brain is doing it, and how does it do it? How does it accomplish these marvelous, delicate, precise, integrated activities using all these different sense systems and at the simultaneously taking inputs from audition and vision and body and controlling the behaviors in such beautifully precise ways. So that for me, there was watching artistic things go on, or watching painters or artists doing pots. And
that's very interesting.
I always realized that the brain was doing this, and that curious as to how it was doing it, what parts were doing it. And so you scoured the literature for any information that would help you, lead you to answers to that general question. So there was never any channeled direction of the research. It just went from here to there and sort of stayed in the present. You had to solve every present problem and explore it with great precision and care. So that's the way I conducted my research. And I've always read the behavioral literature and the neuroanatomical literature and the neurophysiological literature intermixed, because they're all of a kind, I knew. I mean, it had to be. So that interdisciplinary approach to behavior or thought or emotions, just watching an animal in courtship or an animal having sex or yourself having these emotions of any kind, anger, feelings of compassion or love or anything that went through your mind emotionally or thought-wise, was brain activity. And that's the way I always thought of it from very early when I first came. And so I was always thinking about what is doing this and how is it doing it. And the answer always lay somewhere in the brain, in the nervous system. And I still do that today. Mm-hmm. So. I mean, you're sitting there with your finger at your lip.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's whatever reason you do that is, I know what parts of your brain are being active, and there's a reason for you doing it. And so habits, learned behaviors are topics of subject for study as well as everything else. early development. I studied, I raised a lot of animals from infancy, took them from their mothers and sucked them on a bottle and raised them and watched them develop. I do this in my home. I raise a lot of animals in my home. And I had intimate contact with them. So I saw how similar were different mammals in their expressions. And there are parts of the brain that all the mammals have that are very similar.
And this is your comparative approach?
Yeah, so the comparative approach was part of the whole picture. And there's almost too much to handle. I mean, all these facets were being approached, but you couldn't leave anyone out. I mean, you couldn't leave out the sensory inputs if you're looking at behavior, or you couldn't leave out the thinking that goes on behind deciding or problem solving. You had to have a broad perspective about how all these things are done and where in the brain. And the brain was always the source.
The brain was the source of all these phenomena. The question was where.
Where and how it was doing it. Where in the brain it was originating and being information routed and interacted, how the different modalities interacted, producing a result. And there was nothing, no phenomena exempt from being relevant. So this was a broad what was required to be done was an enormous task.
Yeah. Well, Woolsey had one too. You guys didn't deal with little niggling problems. You went right out there. And what did you say at one point to me early on? You said you were looking at the forest, not the trees.
Not the trees or the leaves. But you had to get down and understand the leaves or the composition of the leaves or the root systems. And you had to understand all that at some point to have a comprehensive understanding of this life form. Social behavior was another dimension that had to be considered, because those their social interactions are very delicate and carefully done and complex in time and in space. And so we're always looking at social interactions. We'd go to zoos and watch the animals interact, or watch it with our pets, or with people at parties. And so I was always looking at social activities in a detached way. And I was thinking about when we'd have parties, drinking sort of interfered at some point, but at parties you had a chance of, almost like some of these parties, the din was so great, all voices talking simultaneously and different topics being discussed by this couple or by that couple. You realize the information flow is so complicated, and that the social behavior was. So I learned to be very attentive to cues. If some person would leave a conversation or go do something else or decide to do this or that, or they'd stand and have little habits. Ticks or habits or gestures or verbal habits that were consistent for that person. It was different for another person. A lot of people use ums and ahs in their speech, and just the understanding of speech patterns and became part of the, so I was always looking, trying to analyze and so. That didn't make me very socially. And people would invite me to parties partly when I was drinking because I was a clown or I somehow livened things up. But I don't think I'd go deeply into other people in one-on-one. I'd always want to know how their minds work and why their lives turned out as they did. And but social situations are more complex. It was just noise. And it was harder to make sense of it in terms of brain function, but how the brain were doing all these things was my underlying goal. There was no end of ways to approach it or topics.
Yeah, sometimes people say that it's tough to figure out what to do next with your research.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like you had that problem.
No problem.
At all. What were some of the most significant things you found, you learned in the course of your years of conducting this research?
Well, it was one of the first things, it was because these raccoons became available in the State Department when they had these breeding farms for raccoons, and they had to get rid of them, turn them loose. And they allowed us at the university to use these animals for research. So I've got a large number of them and put them up in the animal care facility and decided to explore their brains, mostly for somatic sensory, since that's an easy to study. Equipment needed is simple. You just need a little pointed stylus, and you had to have the right recording things, and you had to follow these mapping strategies of moving the electrode around and exploring every part of the visible, accessible brain surface, cortical surface. And we did that with a raccoon, and we found, if you look at the fissural pattern of the raccoon, we found there was an enormous part of the raccoon's cortical surface that was brain. You saw it physically, it was a large portion of this part of the brain where somatic sensory would be located. There was a particularly large cluster of gyri and convolutions that turned out by our mapping studies to be inputs from the hand, raccoon's hand. We found that every gyrus, or convolution in this general area, somatic sensory area in the raccoon, every little gyrus received input from a different digit of the hand. If you know raccoons, they do a lot of this kind of stuff.
Right, there you see their.
And so the motor component is strong, but it's obviously they're doing it to sense what it is they're feeling for. And they'll do it looking around, and so they'll grab something, a crustacean or something. And we found that the somatic sensory raccoon for the raccoon's hand area was enormous. It's larger than ours in absolute terms. And every digit had sent inputs to a different gyrus. And the gyrus was, for the thumb was laid out so if you lightly touched this side of the thumb, you'd get evoked activity from one side of the gyrus. And if you marched across the surface of the thumb, the sensory inputs, the electrical potentials, that were evoked from touching these different spots were differently located, and it was like almost a mirror image of the hand. So you realize that brain form was revealing something about the connectivities. And the raccoon's use of these inputs, this brain, the wiring, we never got this far, but how the animal was able to take these inputs and precisely move its hands to adjust to whatever it was feeling. Was this enlarged hand area was responsible for this, but we never got to the point of knowing the timing relationships mm-hmm. of the impulses or how these different finger areas were connected. But that was a major finding of correlation of form with function. And there had been controversy in the literature for some time as to whether there was any relationship between the bumps of the brain and its functional capacity. Phrenologists had long discussed this possibility, but they were put down because there was not clear evidence, because they were just looking at bumps on the skull. Turned out the raccoon hand area pushes against the skull during its developmental growth in a way that you can see the pattern of the convolutions on the skull form, so that we were sort of going back to validating an earlier concept, which was poorly documented, but still the concept was an appropriate one for. And then we went on to study other animals in the raccoon family that had different behaviors but had different brain patterns. And we studied the Quadamundi, which is has a long snout, and it goes around probing with its snout. We found it had a huge snout area. And the snout was, the inputs to the snout gyrus was tightly connected to the pattern, the way the snout appears physically.
Did that surprise you?
Well, no, we chose the Quadamundi because we expected something like that. And we saw the brain, usually obtain a brain specimen before we recorded from it, just to see what it looked like. And you could see that it was different. And so we began to expect that you'd find these correlations between sensory use and brain development. And we found it again and again and again. So that general concept became well documented in our research. I never pushed these concepts publicly because I'm not good at public forums, but people have picked up that concept and acknowledge it as being early seminal research demonstrating the correlation of form and function.
What about publications? Did you publish these findings?
Or? Yeah, we published them in a series of publications. So that the one on sensory inputs from the hand to the cortex was published first. We gave it as a talk first at the meetings and published it as an abstract. Mm-hmm. Then we published it with pictures later on, so that and then the next step was to cut the brain up into thin slices and look at the cortex and see what things look like in depth, and look at the thalamus, which was the station prior to the cortex, to see what it looks like. And it turned out to have little cluster of neurons, each of which was, in our recording experiments in the thalamus, each little group of neurons had inputs from a different digit of the hand. And so the hand area in the thalamus, it was equally differentially enlarged. Then we back down to the medulla where the dorsal column nuclei are and saw that in the cross-section of the medulla you can see these little clusters of cells aligned like this, and the same thing was happening there. So the deep nuclei were organized structurally and grouped in ways that reflected a source from the periphery of their inputs. So we just expanded that general concept to other areas, so that if you find something that's unusually large in an animal, like an olfactory bulb, then you know it's going to have pretty large olfactory life. And
so you did a lot of different mammals.
Yeah, we did a lot of different
mammals. We'll be talking about some of the your comparative mammalian brain collection in just a few moments, and I suspect that that sprang from that research. I want to get the genesis of that in a second, but there's something else I want to talk about first, and that's that eventually, after you became instructors and then tenured people on the faculty, it sounds as if you then became, you and Joe and Joe Hind and Bob Benjamin became heads of your own research groups.
Right. Yeah.
And Woolsey kind of dropped that from his, he was just sort of the supervisor.
And yeah, and he stuck with vision. Mm-hmm. And so he'd worked with visual experiments that were pet projects that he had long thought about. And so he had new groups coming around him to work with him. Mm-hmm. But often the publicity about the work being done here and the training, the fine training was, came, publicity became wider, and so we always had a flow of people from all around the world.
Yeah, you were mentioning he went out all over.
Yeah.
Found people from all over.
So, let me get a bunch of brain casts so you can.
Okay, you were saying you always had to.
Because we're always interested in localizing the functional circuits to parts of the brain, we had to have the brain specimens perfused and sectioned and run through histology and put on glass slides. And that's what our brain collection is, the valuable part of it. That's where it is, and on this box after box of brain sections that are stained for cells or for fibers.
And that you brought out here some casts of brains.
I'll turn the lights so you can get a better view of that.
I'm seeing about 25 or 30 brains.
We have three different boards of this kind, different mammals, from a bat to a porpoise. I've grouped them by, these are pinniped seals. Mm-hmm. It's a harbor seal down there, and this is probably the
sea lion.
Sea lion.
Yeah.
And this is another sea lion, I think, and another type of seal. But we went to Alaska to capture those specimens and perfuse them. These are a cat group.
You went to Alaska personally?
Yeah.
Oh my.
With a lot of equipment for perfusing, for capturing an animal with a capture gun, you know, that would inject it with a sedative and knock it down, and then you could open the chest and you'd have big bottles of saline and formalin that you could, you know, have big catheters to get into the heart. So you open the chest, access the heart, and pass your fluids into it. You cleared the blood out of the brain. So the heart was still pumping when you stuck in these tubes that would flush the blood out of the brain. And you'd follow that saline with formalin, which would go directly up to the brain and fix it real fast so that you didn't have any decay of the brain material. and you ended up with a rigid brain thing. You had to extract this from the animal with rongeurs and big cutters, and you didn't take the brain out, you took the skull away. Mm. So these are enormous tasks. And then you took the brain, put the brain in a bottle of formalin, you took it back home, photographed it, made a brain cast, and by sticking in, mixing up dental rubber and having a bowl full of dental rubber, then you let the brain sink into that. The dental rubber hardened, could pull it apart and pull the brain, lift the brain out, and you can pour in this dental plastic, maybe a brain cast. And these are faithful duplications.
There's a lion.
A lion and some other puma or something like that. It's a domestic cat. These are the raccoon. Oh, what are these? Excuse me.
So you went up to the Aleutian Islands for these seals?
Yeah, we flew up there and camped out, and the local natives and took all our equipment with us so we could get out into the field, and they would herd some seals that would be on the shore. Basking in the sun, and natives would herd them up onto a grassy area, and then we'd shoot them with this capture gun, which injects the anesthetic, and we'd quickly open them up once they were down, open up the rib cage with huge cutters, like wire cutters, and stick the large tubes in the beating heart, and cut a hole in the other side of the heart so the blood returning from the brain would drain out, and the brain would be cleared. And you could pass in the fixative very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said off mic a minute ago that you got a lot of these, but you also purchased them. You could buy animals at that. It was easier to buy animals.
Yeah,
at that
you
point.
Could buy them, and that's a crab breeding raccoon we bought from a dealer, and a lot of the other South American animals we bought that way. We worked with Fish and Wildlife Services in different states, like we got the California sea lion from California Fish and Wildlife. We had to pay freight to get it here, things like that.
At what point did you decide to start a brain collect? Did it just sort of evolve from the brains you were getting?
It evolved from raccoon, and we decided to broaden it to the raccoon family to see how closely related animals, mm-hmm. how their brains differed. And then it would go to a different class of mammals, and or a different order, and or a different family. And we then decided to get as representative a group of all the mammals that exist. Some we didn't get. We didn't get the aardvark. We got two types of anteaters. Hmm. Well, we got a hyrax, so we have an elephant brain. And
now, by we, you mean?
Well, our lab.
Your lab.
I did all this brain removal. The zoo had a zebra that in the winter stepped into a hole and broke a hook. Its leg, and they decided to put it down, and so I had it. I was on the board of the zoo, so they called me, and I went over there, and we anesthetized it, brought it back to the lab in my Jeep, took it up to the animal care room on the elevator on a cart, and rolled it into the. It was still living, but it was anesthetized. And then we did the sequences we needed to fix the brain. And we did that for every animal.
How many brains, how many different animals did you end up having?
275.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot.
Now, is this, I don't know anything about brain collection, so is this an extremely large brain collection?
It's probably the largest in the world. And
wow.
My colleague Jack Johnson, who worked with me for about 5 years as a postdoc and apprentice, worked together on this. He was interested in comparative work as well, and he helped me in a lot of these endeavors, not only recording, but he was equally motivated, he still is, to get the brains out intact, perfuse them in the proper way, instead with standardized techniques, cut them with standardized techniques. He set up his lab in Michigan State to do exactly the same things we did here.
Now you're in the process of, go ahead, did you say something? You're in the process of transferring these to the Museum of Health and Medicine
Yes.
in Washington, D.C. How did that whole thing come about?
Well, we realized that we were getting older and that this collection was sitting there and it was going to be somewhere else that come in and use
right.
the space. So we realized we had to find a home for it. And we went to Washington and talked to people at NIH and NSF, and we got to the museum, National Museum of Health and Medicine, which is part of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology attached to the Walter Reed General Hospital. So the Defense Department has funding control of the National Museum where these specimens went. But they obtain specimens every all around the country, the huge brain collection, human brain collection from Harvard was sent there when that professor died. And there are brains, human brains of all kinds, different ages, sectioned in different planes. They were sent to Washington, and the museum made this huge arrays of shelves that which these huge glass slides were placed on the shelf with a stained section. Paul Yakovlev at Harvard was the one who did the main collection for the human material. Conrad Achert gave us the prototype of how to perfuse and fix the brains and to take them out carefully so that there wasn't damage. And he played an influential role at that one early point. And we just followed that rigid recipe. Standardized the techniques, and Jack Johnson of Michigan State decided to specialize in marsupials from Australia.
Hmm.
So he collected a whole bunch of kangaroos and wallabies and wombats and Tasmanian devils and stuff like that. So his collection is being merged online. The grant we just submitted was get 3 more years of support to finish the moves.
How much of it is moved at this point?
About half of my collection, none of Jack Johnson's is gone.
Now you worked on the Florida manatee.
Well, we realized that the manatee was an outlier group that was very unusual. Its brain is large and it's very smooth. I think I have a cast right here I can get to show you.
Wait, you're talking about the manatee is having a brain the size of your fist?
Yeah, and it's not highly fissured like these. It may be as large as one of the sea lions, but it's a very smooth surface.
What does that mean?
Well, that's what we were curious about, why it would be so smooth. And so we got about 10 specimens and immersed them in formalin, and some of them were just freshly dead, so they were just nicely preserved. But anyway, we got them fixed and embedded in saloidin and sectioned and stained. We had a grant for about 6 years to do that work. And we've that material we've reported somewhat on it, but we haven't finished the analysis of the brain.
What are you finding about the smooth areas? What are your hypotheses? Or
my hypothesis is that the animal is has very little locomotor demands, just floating around slowly, doesn't have a lot of fast activities like a deer would, which is highly efficient, or a seal that has all these maneuvers, or a cat or a dog or primate. So its behavioral repertoire is relatively simple. Its social life is relatively simple. Its emotional life is relatively simple. It doesn't anger, it doesn't fight. Its social activities are rather gentle and casual. So my hypothesis is that all these separate gyri, which in animals that are complicated in their behavioral styles, didn't happen in the manatee, so that brain was large relatively because an animal gets larger in body size, you have to have more cells to control a given member than it would if it were smaller, so that you have more muscle outputs, there's more sensory surfaces, and so so the brain is large, but there was not this complicated. That led to the idea that the folding is related to the complexity of the animal's repertoire.
Interesting.
Of sensation or behavior.
Is that something you would have expected, or?
Well, that evolved out of trying to ascertain why these things occur as they do.
Is the manatee going to be in your brain collection eventually?
Yes. Yeah, it'll be there. It's still in my office. We've done some papers on it, but we're going to run out of steam before. So the collection will be available for study.
Could you do this kind of thing today, this kind of brain collection? Would it be possible?
You could still get animals, yeah. Zoos have animals that die, and you could still get a gorilla, probably, or a chimpanzee, or any of the big cats, or skunks, or weasels, or whatever.
You had mentioned John Johnson, who's at the University of Michigan State, MSU,
right,
who's worked with you on this brain collection, and he was one of these postdocs who came in and who was in your research group.
Yep.
You have, I'm sure, had many, many postdocs over the course of your years, and I'm sure that each one is special in their own way. But are there any, Johnson would obviously be one, are there any who kind of jump out at you that you'd like to talk about for a moment or two?
Well, Johnson continued with somatic sensory research, which he and I did here. He authored several papers, primary author in exploration of the sensory projections to the medulla, medullary nuclei, underneath the cerebellum. And then there's Lillian Pubels, who came and worked with me, and she's now at NIH, but she decided to take the spider monkey. Spider monkey has a prehensile tail, so she mapped its somatic sensory area and discovered it.
Oh, so what you might do with a student is just assign a mammal.
Assign them a mammal.
Oh, how, what a clean, yeah, that's great.
Same thing as Woolsey did with us.
Yeah, perfect.
Benjamin Pubels married Lillian here. She was in psychology here. Benjamin Pubels worked with me, with Jack Johnson, on recording from single fibers that come in from the body periphery. He found a way of immobilizing a segment of the spinal cord and the nerves that come into it, the dorsal roots, so that you could take a very sharp electrode and puncture the axon, and it would stick, and you could occur these huge individual spikes from sensory input from a joint or hairs or skin surface. And so that was their first order of inputs that we studied using that method. We did it on the raccoon, the coatimundi, and domestic cat. So we had some comparative evidence of what kind of receptive fields were out there. And when you're recording from single neurons, you'll find that the sensory spot that activates that single axon is very tiny. We also did it for the trigeminal nucleus, which feeds sensory nerves to the head. It's located underneath the brain, so you'd have to take out one hemisphere and expose this big ganglion, which is the cell group, peripheral cell group that takes the input from the snout of a coati, for coatimundi, for example. And we found that if you look at a dog's foot or a cat's foot, you find those little eminences of tissue, of skin, naked skin. We have fingerprints, but the dogs and cats and raccoons have a little pads that may be 1 or 2 millimeters across. If you look at them closely, you'll see how they're structured. But the coati's snout also had this. It had a large naked snout, which it used to probe the surface of everything that it was curious about. We found that sometimes the input from one of these sensory nerves to the trigeminal ganglion, which is analogous to the single fibers coming in from the spinal cord, that it its receptor was located in just a crevice of these little eminences, so that you could activate it by pressing the whole pad, the whole snout. If you went with the finer and finer wires, which is what we found we had to do to produce less, smaller pressures, you could find the receptor would be very finely localized to a very tiny bit of skin. And then we did sections of the skin and looked at sensory receptors to see how they were laid out. We found in the raccoon sensory receptors in the fingers were very dense and great numbers in the skin, whereas in the coati that was receptors were very dense in the snout. So those kind of findings came along, just discoveries that told you more about how the system was put together, how it functioned.
So when you went into one of these, when you started a new mammal, you would have a procedure that you would follow, but you would constantly be finding these unexpected types of things that would probably be some of the more interesting might turn out to be.
There are always the fun parts, because new discoveries. So that
and the motivating force through all this was the curiosity, that powerful curiosity. Yep. That's very interesting.
We published a paper, a woman who was one of my students is now at Harvard. She is, we decided to study the North American beaver. It has this big paddle tail. Mm-hmm. We were curious to see how its sensory areas of the brain looked. And it also has a fairly large brain, the size of a cat brain, but it's also smooth. Mm-hmm. Isn't convoluted. But we mapped its somatic sensory area on the cortex and found the area for the tail, which is very small, which indicated that it didn't use the tail in a sensory way. Mm-hmm. More like a rudder and a paddle.
Yeah.
So we have beaver brain sections in the collection. So we chose different animals partly because they were new or different or had some specialization in the behavioral repertoire.
Like the tail of the beaver.
Yeah.
Make it
that made them, made us curious as to what, how the brain was put together. And always, in my case, it was always using somatic sensory. Yeah, there was enough work to do with that that took all our time.
Did you ever share animals with Bob and with Joe who were looking at other aspects of it?
No, we would often give parts of the animal to the zoology department who would want, who didn't have a specimen of skeleton or this or that animal. But usually we had to preserve the brain that we were studying completely, and so someone else couldn't be entering into it. So we didn't do that much. Everybody had their own projects, their own animal specimens.
Just a couple of general wrap-up questions. You were in the department from 54 until you retired in, what, 1990?
Yeah.
This is just a big general question, but what were the main changes that you saw within the department and within the field in that period of time?
The main changes were people looking at ever finer and finer details. A lot of people now work up there with cells they've taken out of an animal and put in a dish. You go inside the cell with a pipette, record potentials from different parts of inside of a single neuron. So how individual neurons and their dendrites and axons carry electrical charge or generate electrical charge or transmit electrical charge has been studied in greater detail in the later years. And then also to the molecular aspects of transmission of neuron impulses or the structure of the cell, nerve cell. There are aspects to synaptic exchange of chemicals and electrical activity that allow one neuron to pass its information along to the next neuron, and often filtering it in certain ways or modifying information. And that's often what happens at these different relay stations, that some different information processing is done on inputs and outputs. So that labs have become more molecular based.
And that would be for, what, two reasons? Because you guys did that early work which led to this, and because the technology has changed.
Yeah, the technology has advanced. And
so incredibly since.
You can do all these more specific chemical analysis.
Were there any technology things that came out during your career that fundamentally changed the way you operated your...
Well, we standardized techniques that someone had invented, and for the histological processing, for example, or the way to record from the brain were standardized. We invented a microelectrode that was good at recording big potentials from little tiny areas. So we always went to finer and finer electrodes to get more precise localization. Initially, you're recording evoked potentials, which was responsive large populations of neurons to an input, say a touch. But with time, you've got to record from smaller groups of neurons and finally single neurons. So you would see how individual cells would process inputs and what the inputs, what the firing patterns looked like. You could always tell in the thalamus, for example, when you were encountering neurons from the teeth, because they'd have a different character to them. They sounded different when you heard them over the speaker. Spikes were finer. I think they were probably smaller cells. But not a little observation of that kind that sort of disappeared in the noise of all information that's been obtained.
What about the training of people in your field today? Is that significantly different from the kind of training you and Bob and Joe Hind had?
It's still pretty much apprenticeship. Usually we require students these days to take certain courses. Background anatomy or neurochemistry courses. We learned all those things by doing them and reading the literature. The training, the way that the training is done is pretty much the same.
Okay.
It's apprenticeship. You learn how to do it yourself. And you become an independent researcher and you can go off to another university and start your own lab.
If this is one of those kind of corny questions, but it's a provocative one. If you had it to do over again, what changes, if any, did you make in your course of your career?
I don't know that I would have done anything different. I would have just followed my nose.
Yeah. That's great. Final question. Do you have any closing comments you would like to make about your career at the university?
Well, I've been very fortunate to be allowed to do whatever I wanted to do. I was not required to teach, although there was a lot of pressure in the later years. And because of my temperament, my character, the way I approach search for understanding and knowledge, required me to just have open-ended exploration. It's back to the play and exploratory behavior. It has to be fun, it has to be something interesting and challenging, and you have to have the freedom and the techniques, the money to do it. So you need the support of the institution all up and down.
Great. Thank you very much. End of interview.